Hi, this is Alina and Megan, and you're listening to Move Your Brain, Move Your Body podcast, where we dive into all things health, wellness, and fitness.
We are two certified athletic trainers, personal trainers, and nutrition coaches who met and graduated together from the University of Arkansas. And we want to do this podcast to spread our joy about treating our bodies well through nutrition, exercise, and knowledge. Today on the podcast, we welcome Erin Murray. Erin is a nutrition, health, and strength coach that splits her time between clients and academia. Her passion for science and whole foods directs much of her work, where she focuses on transforming biochemistry into delicious meal ideas, actionable steps, and a sustainable new lifestyles for her clients. Her work also centers around a whole systems approach, where she synthesizes research on food, climate, and biological sciences to work towards building people and communities that make an American food culture a healthier and more holistic one. She is currently finishing her two secondary degrees, a Master's of Science in Nutrition and Health Promotion, as well as her clinical work to be a dietitian. She sees clients online from around the globe, in addition to teaching and working in a microbiome research library. Her deep belief in the connections between a person, land, and food guides her own lifestyle so that she may lead by example. For that reason, you will find Erin in the kitchen, her garden, or with her chickens if she's not in the lab or the gym. Welcome to the podcast, Erin.
We're so excited to have you on. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm well, thank you.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you do so that our listeners can find out about you.
Awesome. So long story short, I guess, I started coaching clients almost, we're getting close to a decade now, because I started as a CrossFit coach in the very beginning of my undergrad. So I really fell in love with training when I started CrossFitting, and then I realized that I also loved coaching people. And so I spent a lot of time with clients in that space, but was earning my undergraduate degree. And then a lot of different things came together that led me down the road to study nutrition more formally. So I earned nutrition coaching certifications and things like that, so I could work with clients in that capacity. But then I ended up wanting to study really kind of formal nutrition science and biochemistry. So I did my didactic program in dietetics, which is the medical requirements to be a dietitian. So now I just need to do my clinical rotations. And then I'm also finishing up my research for my Master's of Science in Nutrition Research. So I'm just finishing that up now. So I still work with clients and I do nutrition coaching all through those years and continue to do so. And then I work in a laboratory that studies the microbiome.
Wow. Cool. So what is your research in?
So my research currently that we're looking to conduct is actually nutritional changes or dietary changes due to COVID-19 containment phases. So kind of looking at some quantitative data there, because all we have is qualitative. So that's the current nutrition research I'm looking at. And then the microbiome research is in a bioinformatics laboratory. So basically all metagenomics and then epidemiologic analysis of those findings.
Cool. Wow. Yeah. Nutrition research is so hard because it's like, it's really all epidemiological.
Oh, yes.
Realistically, unless it's in mice or something, you know?
Absolutely. Food recall and just kind of observational stuff is our biggest hurdle for sure.
Yeah. So you made a post maybe a week or so ago and it really spoke to me. And it was basically the premises was there's not only one way of eating. Can you go a little bit deeper into that? Because I know that especially the climate that we have on social media and just like word spreading super fast. There's so many like, you know, zealot camps. And why is that not necessarily the best way to go about things?
Yeah, that's really good 30,000 foot view question to start looking at this stuff. That's perfect. So I made that post because this is something that the nutrition space specifically is just really, really suffering from. And what we would call this in medicine is just patient first care. And I think the training space and the nutrition coaching space has to have client first coaching, which is basically that every client that walks through the door is going to have their own needs, their own background, their own goals, their own perceptions even. And I think nutrition gets really trapped with you know, we all have belief systems, and that's a box that already is existing in our mind. And when we take information in, we form fit information to fit our pre-existing framework. So we're really manipulating thought and shape as we take in information. And then nutrition suffers pretty badly from then taking that and laying that on top of everyone we see. And that creates a lot of limited discussions, but also a lot of arguing. Because we might have an approach that would really help one person and their goals and their lifestyles, and that approach might not be a good fit for the next client and the next and the next and the next. And so when we kind of, it's that danger of a single story, right? We do that with so much, and we kind of can't afford to do that with science and medicine, but nutrition often is. So I just always find it interesting if a clinician identifies as, I'm a vegan dietitian, for example, not to pick on them because there's not many, but then you might, every patient you see, if you're identifying as one type of clinician, do you then put everyone on that one plan? What if that's not a good fit for someone? So just kind of taking away labels and trying to be as open and kind of scientific as possible, but also nutrition and other sciences too, but nutrition space also deals a lot with kind of cherry picking and then getting into these mindsets or these kind of identity camps, food identities, and then fighting about those. And that just kind of doesn't help the public, doesn't help elevate the discussion, definitely doesn't help our clients and patients. So I just like to get away from labels in all capacities. And then, so if we see one eating strategy work for someone, we don't need to be reactive or try to correct them or judge them for it. We can just know, hey, maybe that works really well for that person. If a vegan diet did work amazingly well for someone, I say more power to you. And if that doesn't work great for the next person, we'll find something that works great for them. So just a lot of flexibility and open-mindedness, I think, is continually needed in this space.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is so important because people get stuck to, you know, doing what they've always done or doing what they think works for them. And then they kind of will push it onto other people, whether it's a clinician or just a normal human. So yeah. We all have our views on food. I know both Megan and I have tried multiple things and, you know, have had our fair share with food. And let's go a little deeper into the different camps and maybe just give us a little view about each one of the camps, I guess, and what people are looking for.
I mean, what I wanted to point out was that, like, people, you know, they try something and it works for them. And instead of thinking about why becoming a vegan helped you lose weight because you started eating vegetables and less, like, you know, processed meat, I guess, is obviously probably the swap that people have. So maybe go into, like, people don't think about why something works and that maybe other things may work as well. And that there's kind of something that all these things have in common. And it's not necessarily that there's only one way, you know, so go ahead and talk. I just wanted to say that really quick.
you're spot on. A lot of these camps, they don't realize, have an awful lot in common, which is they reduce energy intake often by reducing processed food intake. Even if you, whether you go carnivore or vegan, you probably are eating a ton less processed food. That's going to change energy intake. You're eating more whole foods either way. That's going to change energy intake. Satiation, satiety, things like that. And sometimes it is kind of, for some personalities and some lifestyles, it is easier just to literally cut something out and not have it rather than have a little because they maybe haven't been coached in finding that balance or something like that. So people, and which actually brings up another good point, which we always kind of measure diets by how much weight you lose, which I think is like a whole other problem. But you'll hear about, oh, my coworker lost weight on blank, vegan, carnivore, keto, like insert name here. And there wasn't necessarily this magical elixir about that diet. They probably just started eating less calories than what they were burning. They got into an energy deficit. They were eating more whole foods, which typically is going to be healthier. And so they did lose some weight. Whether that a diet ended up being ideal for the body, I think is probably debatable. Weight loss is only one measurement of dietary pattern. So, but yes, that kind of basic foundational block of that pyramid, weight loss or changing body composition is always going to be energy intake, no matter what. We're all slaves to thermogenesis. So there's no way getting around that.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting that you're saying that because it comes down to a few things. And I think everybody is different. Your gut health is going to determine a lot of, you know, how you kind of process your foods, if you can actually break things down. And people definitely go towards weight loss, but maybe that's not the best measure.
Yeah. So what are some of the like long-term effects? So say, for example, you know, keto will work for people. Vegan will also work for people for, you know, let's just say, for example, losing weight, which is most people's goal. Let's be real.
Yeah.
What are some of the long-term? So like if you decide to go keto and you do it for a year and you lose a ton of weight, and then you decide to kind of like get out of that because you're sick of only eating keto, what are some of the like physiological effects that your body goes through, like the adaptations that it'll go through with a ketogenic diet or a vegan diet, or, you know, deficiencies that you can run into, things like that? Do you have any advice for people?
Yeah, absolutely. So as we change diets, and this is honestly just, I think it just shows how cool we are, is that our bodies adapt an unbelievable amount. People don't realize it doesn't necessarily mean a diet was the end all be all. Like when people fast and then say, I'm not even hungry. I think that says an awful lot about how cool your systems are. Not that fasting is kind of this magical spell that really changed your metabolism. And same thing goes for those fat forward diets, extremely low carbohydrate diets, which are very low protein diets. Our body is always going to be, it really is an adaptive machine. Probably, arguably in a lot of ways, the most adaptive machine on planet Earth, constantly adjusting and making arrangements for whatever is being taken in. So a really good example of this, actually, my sister just dealt with anemia, and she is actually dating someone who's a vegetarian, love them both to pieces, but protein intake decreased. She was dealing with some physiological changes because of this that were concerning. There was a lag time, they started appearing, and she got her labs tested. But within kind of a few weeks before getting the labs, I talked to her about it, and she immediately started increasing protein intake. So in her serum labs, iron was fine, but transferrin was really high.
That's interesting.
So what does that tell us? And this is something that I think is so cool about our bodies. But whenever we have a deficiency, we're always going to upregulate transporters for that nutrient. Mm-hmm. So when I see transferrin high, you know that body was like, we don't have enough iron, get the bus on the road, whatever iron we can get, we're going to try to deliver. So that starts turning out more transport proteins.
It starts robbing the body of it.
It's going to say whatever we can get, we have to have all hands on deck kind of, so that we can suck up any of that iron that we are getting because we're not getting enough. We'll see that with so many nutrients. We always are going to upregulate transporters when we need more of something. So your body is going to do things with enzymes, transporters, energy production, and it's going to adjust in really unbelievable ways to kind of make it work. It might siphon nutrients from one area to get them into another, like calcium. We can't use blood serum calcium that's not a meaningful lab at all, because your body is going to tightly regulate that so much. If I see someone's serum calcium, unless something is very wrong and it's been wrong for a long, long time, that calcium is going to be in a normal range because your body's taking it out of your bones and putting it into the bloodstream because it's going to be so tightly regulated, just like pH. So your body can do amazing things and it's going to adjust, but sometimes those adjustments are costly. But it's going to try to keep you alive. It's going to try to keep those key homeostatic factors in their small, narrow ranges. And it's going to try to keep the lights on upstairs. So stuff's going to be sent to the blood and things like that.
So what's a better way of looking at calcium? Like, I guess your stores, like just bone density, would you say, or?
Bone density, dietary intake, I would assess. I'd get someone kind of in chronometer for a few weeks and see what's going on. There's a couple different labs that they can run to. Bone density is kind of gold standard, things like that. But exactly, that's why sometimes labs are deceiving, because calcium is so tightly regulated. By the time that's out of range, there's been a problem for a really long time and someone's in a bad place.
So if pH, I'm sorry, I have so many questions.
Yeah, okay.
I love nutrition. I think it's amazing. I think honestly, one of the biggest keys to helping our country deal with its health problems would be to like globally just get everyone on the same page with like no zealots or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you mentioned that obviously our body really regulates pH tightly because it's vital to function, like all of our organs. And there's this big like fad of like alkaline everything. Is there anything like, is that valuable at all?
Sadly, no.
I just like set you up for a trap. Yeah. Sorry.
No, you're right. You're fine. It's tough. You know, like if you look on Google about alkaline stuff, I mean, we do kind of snicker about this a little bit in the back room sometimes, because the stuff that you see on Instagram, like I actually saw this pH. It was almost like it looked like a speedometer, and it was like your pH. And it was literally like when you started getting more acidic, it was like inflammation, diabetes, like cancer. And the acid level, it was like a pH of like 2 or something like that. And it's like, yeah, you might have cancer, but you are dead long before you get to a pH of 2. You would never know if you were going to get cancer. Yeah. Those pH values are so tightly regulated. We have buffering systems all throughout, even the GI tract, all throughout the bloodstream, all of our bicarbonate and phosphate buffers, all over the place. And those, they keep it in such a narrow range that I do kind of, I get the intention of something like an alkaline diet, and honestly, it feels good because he ate veggies, mm-hmm. but totally, absolutely not shifting physiological pH. Thankfully, we would die if it was shiftable like that, but not so much. I think people just feel good when they go on it because they're eating more whole foods.
So this might be a stupid question to follow up on that, but like, so our stomach is supposed to be super acidic, yes. and many people's is not. So would having like a super alkaline diet, could that like make the stomach have to work a little bit harder? Is that like even possible? Or
so it kind of depends on what the pathology is. So something that actually will change stomach pH. So pH in the stomach is supposed to be about a 2. Mm-hmm. So that's true hydrochloric acid. That's the same pH as battery acid. That's why acid reflux hurts. Mm-hmm. That is a problem, but it actually, we want it to be super acidic. That's why there's concerns over proton pump inhibitors and things like that, because we actually do want that acid. I think the bigger question is to wonder why is that sphincter opening at the end of the esophagus, but I digress. But anyways, if there is a problem there in the stomach where HCl isn't getting secreted properly, that can be a couple different types of pathologies. Eating alkaline foods probably won't shift that much, but someone who's not secreting enough HCl might have damage to their parietal cells. There might be another issue going on there. Sometimes with age, acidity declines, and then we're not denaturing proteins as efficiently, and then we're not getting enough B12. So we actually, you're right. We do want that to be acidic. And if someone's not producing enough HCl, that can totally be a problem.
So actually, it's funny. I'm actually reading right now why stomach acid is good for you. And I think mm-hmm. there's this whole like stigma in our society against stomach acid. People are always taking yeah. like what Pepto, all those things. I don't know if Pepto-Bismol mm-hmm. actually decreases, but there's a million different.
Yeah. Prilosec, things like yeah. Tums.
Pepsid, Tums, all that. I used to live on Tums, whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah. So I think maybe go a little bit into why that might not be the long-term solution for people. And I know pharmaceutical companies make a lot more money off that type of stuff than they would off of a digestive enzyme. And maybe talk a little bit about digestive enzymes, because it's been yeah. helpful for me. So I know people listening will find that interesting.
Yeah, this is a big one. A lot of people yeah. do deal with heartburn and acid reflux and burping and things like that. But we actually do want, we totally want that stomach to get to about a pH of 2, because a lot happens in that network. So the GI tract is neat. It's kind of like all these caverns, like these chambers. Then there's these little sphincters that let things through the gate very slowly. And what comes in triggers a lot of necessary chemical pathways. So for example, when we have healthy digestion and we get that, so when we first chew food, it starts mixing with saliva, some digestive enzymes, antimicrobial proteins, alpha amylases in saliva. By the time that is getting masticated and then swallows and goes through the esophagus, we call that a bolus of food. So then the bolus of food enters the stomach, and we need then, so when that appears, a lot of pathways are triggered, that then we start secreting hydrochloric acid. That hydrochloric acid then starts denaturing proteins. It kills potential invaders. It actually liberates a lot of micronutrients. So a lot of minerals and things like B12 are liberated specifically by the acid. That's why we see nutrient deficiencies when people take proton pump inhibitors, because they don't have an acidic enough stomach. They can't liberate these key nutrients. So then by the time we have the acid mixing with that bolus of food, we now call that chyme. It's very slushy. It's very liquid. liquid by then. And that's going to be in the stomach for a while. There's a lot of longitudinal muscles in there that really kind of churn food on a diagonal. There's a lot of really cool layers of muscle in the stomach. And then that's going to drip into the small intestine. Now, the small intestine needs the chyme to enter, but the chyme also with that pH of 2 is going to trigger the release of bicarbonate. So then the small intestine is really neat because it's going to release bicarbonate and bring that pH back up to a pH of 8. So we cope with that pH very specifically. Yeah, we get rid of that acid very quickly. And then all of our pancreatic enzymes and small intestine enzymes then can kind of go to work on these bigger molecules, and they only work in a less acidic environment. So they wouldn't work in the acid of the stomach, for example. So that's why when we take a digestive enzyme, we need it to get through the stomach safely. This is why a digestive enzyme powder can be a problem. Enzymes are proteins, and what denatures proteins? A pH of 2. So you actually are taking a supplement that your own body is just like washing that away, breaking that up. That enzyme would never work in that environment. So we do want a good digestive enzyme to be encapsulated properly so it can get delivered into the small intestine and survive that hydrochloric acid.
What do you think about green supplements? Kind of off topic. A lot of them have digestive enzymes, and that's really a powder. It's a straight up powder. I mean, and that's not the only thing, but
I always do think of the digestive enzymes, and they don't say, and it's really hard. I actually have tried to track this down. There's a supplement that I do love. Green supplements, I think, have total utility. There's tons of people that struggle to get their veggies in, and especially if it helps with digestion, it can be a nice dose of fiber, get some chlorella in there and some spirulina. Why not? Definitely no problem, but you're totally right. They often do also market it as having digestive enzyme inside, but I always do wonder, okay, are you encapsulating this in something inside the powder? Because my stomach is destroying this. So I don't think those powdered digestive enzymes have much utility, but the rest of the supplement I still love. So I still cool. take your greens as well.
Yeah, I do too. And they're so expensive. So I'm like wondering if it's worth investing in still. Because one of the other questions I had, sorry, Alina, did you have a question? I feel like I'm literally like.
No, it's fine. You're good.
Okay. So I'm about to go. I'm starting physical therapy school in a week, actually.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really excited. But one thing I'm not excited about is like, I'm plan on trying to like personal train still a little bit, mm-hmm. but obviously like I'm living on loans for the biggest part. Yeah. So thinking of like, I mean, not like I'm pretty frugal with like spending on food anyway, but do you have any recommendations for people who are trying to make sure that they're really seeking appropriate nutrients on a budget? Because I know that most people think that eating healthy has to be really expensive. And I don't think that's necessarily the case, but it's also hard to know, like, you know, the little tips and tricks.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And this is one where, I mean, kind of actually with really all of our nutrition, we're always going to seek the right tool for the job at the right time. And that tool, job, and time can change. But we have to kind of measure the cost benefit. So for something like buying that kind of high end, I won't even say organic, because organic, there's actually some concerns with organic production. If we go all the way to like regeneratively farmed, and that's like the really good stuff, right? That might be more expensive. That might be at our farmers markets and things like that, especially for the protein. Yeah. But the cool thing about vegetables, and actually also protein, like animal proteins, they're so nutritious that even when they're not farmed or produced well, they're still nutritious. Like when people are like, I would never eat, you know, industrially raised beef. Truthfully, it's that nutritious that it's still good for you. It's not good for the environment, and there's other concerns. But if someone is coming to me and saying, Erin, I do not have the money to buy regenerative, I can't go to the farmer's market, what do? Buy the best protein you can. Fresh veggies are awesome, but truthfully, so are frozen and canned. You don't have to go organic right now if it's not a good fit. The traditionally grown stuff, there's environmental concerns and things like that, but if someone is trying to eat well and do the best they can right now and there's some limitations, it actually really nutritionally is not bad whatsoever to eat frozen or canned or things like that.
Got it.
Good information to know, because I know a lot of people will avoid eating meat because of that reason. Maybe they think it's bad for the environment. And I do think we need to get somebody on this podcast to talk about environment and
regenerative agriculture. Yeah.
Because there is really conception going on. And I don't know if you've read Sacred Cow, but that's a really good book. And we'll link all that too in the show notes. But
this is one of my favorite topics. It's actually one of the reasons I studied microbiology, because the soil has a microbiome.
Oh, so well, maybe you can just talk about it a bit, because I think there's this misconception about meat and how it's bad for the environment when it could actually be the thing that heals our environment.
Yeah, you're right. And this is a tough space of science, because this is where some moral beliefs or emotional arguments kind of really enter the room. But if we really zoom out, and I think it's our responsibility to zoom out, because we need to look at ecosystems and consider that we might not be the most important part of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And that is to say then that, well, how do these ecosystems function? And one of the key components of grasslands, which over a third of the planet is grassland. Grasslands require very special drought-resistant grasses with very deep root systems to hold their topsoil in them. So when we look at like the American West, for example, before white settlers got here and kept pushing west and killing all the bison, what was roaming? Millions of bisons, massive herds were roaming, and they roam all over North America and the breeds we have here, the species we have here, but other continents have the same thing. These are ruminants, herd ruminants that graze. And what do? They move. And they move because of pressure, predator pressure. Like if coyotes and wolves are, you know, funneling towards the bison, it's really going to move the herd forward. But they also never stay where they defecate and urinate. They move past where they've eaten and gone to the bathroom, for lack of a better word. And that makes them move. So what's interesting, though, is now we look at what's happening in soil, where that's happening naturally. Because, again, my bias, and I'll admit my bias, is always going to be geared towards a natural ecosystem. Like what happens here if we don't interfere? And this is what happens. The ruminants move through, and when they bite on grass and chew through once, for lack of a better term, it stimulates root growth. And so when a plant then is also growing more deeply below the surface, it's enriching and feeding in a super symbiotic manner the soil. So what are we doing too when we do that? The grass is getting stronger, richer, more lush, more diverse, and topsoil rich. And topsoil does two key things. It holds water. Now this is why prairies naturally contain drought resistant grasses. Those grasses don't necessarily make it rain, kind of in a large water cycle we see that they do, but they also hold when it does rain. When we hold, we have richer topsoil. When we have rich topsoil, we sequester and hold carbon. And that's a natural carbon life cycle. So with meat production, we have obviously, you know, the industrial model is completely removed and divorced from that natural ecosystem cycle. Yeah. But some really forward thinking, it's funny because it might seem very backwards because this is just how an ecosystem works, but these farmers that are implementing this are very forward thinking, and they're actually paying out of pocket for carbon life cycle analysis on their farms, and their net carbon sinks. And this is so important, because we use that word sustainable. I feel like we've done so much damage at this point. We can't just be sustainable. We have to be regenerative.
Yeah.
And that's why sequestering that carbon, and we can do this with plants also, which is why organic production, there are some concerns, because organic production has to typically till more. And what do when we're tilling? We're destroying topsoil, releasing carbon, and killing the microbiome in that soil. So we want to see that regenerative, this is not regulated yet by the FDA. I think that's coming, but we have to see these regenerative practices where there might be cover crops and no-till practices and regenerative and holistic grazing management and things like that.
Oh, if only the FDA just regulated it so that all farming had to be regenerative, we'd save the whole planet. And that's so sad. Or the government regulated it like that, but I don't think that's going to happen. There's too much money behind it.
It's all about money.
I know.
Yeah. So
a lot of things are apparently.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, something else that I can't remember. I think it was the Genius Life podcast that I was listening to. And it was actually from a while back, like over the summer, but it was a doctor he's a functional medicine doctor, which is obviously a newer model of medicine that I personally think was what we need to kind of move towards for, because most people in the United States that have medical problems, it's like lifestyle caused medical problems. Mm-hmm. And so obviously a functional approach is more beneficial than just like giving them more drugs for their drugs, you know. But what he was talking about was how obviously functional medicine is a very expensive route to go right now. And that's not realistic for the majority of people, which are, you know, a lot of the people who have all these health problems are actually underprivileged people that have less money. But he was talking about a group model, which actually, if you think about like diabetes, for the most part, is more similar to like alcoholism than some other sort of disease that you just get that is not caused by addiction to food or other things like that. And that's obviously not necessarily everybody that has type 2 diabetes, but I would say a large majority, it's, you know, a misunderstanding of how to eat healthy, but also just like an attachment to food that could be useful to actually work in a group setting where you have that community and that social support and those connections. So I don't know, what do you think about that? And have you heard about that at all? It's actually at the Cleveland Clinic, I think, is where he worked.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, I haven't heard about that group setting, but it makes a lot of sense. And healthcare definitely does some really, really serious hurdles right now. It's definitely a lot of disease chasing rather than prevention, which is a really big problem. And kind of, well, there's also always a lag in research too, right? So that mm-hmm. always makes kind of our classic medical model hesitate because they're worried about mistreating, making an error, getting sued, things like that. And then there might be tests that insurance companies would never cover, like stool samples and kind of trying to get microbiome signatures or allergies and things like that. So there's definitely a money problem here. So the group model is super interesting to me. I'll definitely have to investigate that because this is a big hurdle that I haven't seen solutions for yet. And I think that's exactly right. And that's a big problem. And the functional medicine space is interesting because they're definitely trying to talk about like whole systems biology. And then our classic medical model is doing their best with what are meta-analyses showing us and things like that. And I think bringing those two worlds together is going to be essential moving forward.
I agree. 100%. Well, we like to ask every single one that we have, every guest we have on our podcast, what they do every day to move their brain or move their body. And I think this is not going to be the only episode we have with you because you have so yeah. much great information and 40-ish, 45 minutes is not enough time to spread it. So no. We definitely want to have you on again. It's just, you just have such great info.
Thank you. I'd love to come back. I love talking about this stuff.
It's fun, right?
I promise. I'm not usually this obnoxious with questions, I promise, but I have a list over here.
No, not at all. Nutrition's cool because it intersects with so many other sciences, right? And you guys are movement professionals and going to PT school, which is super exciting. Yeah. So you know how critical this science is.
Yeah, yes. So
to PT as well. So yeah, we'll have to have you on again.
To healing, to everything. And I mean, we talked so much today about all different things, but we didn't even talk about like macro counting. So there's so many other things. Yeah. And just like protein, carbs, and fat and other fiber, whatever. So mm-hmm. we'll definitely have you on again to talk more spread of this information. But what do you do to move your brain or move your body every day? But it doesn't really have to be every day.
Good question. So I'm definitely a creature of habit. I'm someone who on the spectrum of order and chaos, I really like order. I think that's the scientist in me. And Megan, you're going into school too. So you're going to like feel these vibes all the way. But when you're mm-hmm. so committed to so much learning time every day, I don't know how to survive without really strict schedule. So for my body, I get up at 4:50 every day and I'm at the gym by 5:15. It's the best time. I'm a morning person. Like that used to be my reading hours, but I actually changed that to my training hours and I wouldn't have it any other way. I mug a coffee. I get to the gym in the dark. You know, I absolutely love it. Lift for at least an hour a day. Do some PRI, do lots of fun stuff. And then I come home, shower, coffee, protein, green shake, red shake, and then usually start reading a few hours or doing quiet work or jump right into client work. It depends on the day.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. How can people reach you? What's your Instagram handle?
So my Instagram is Erin's Uncommon Eats. And then you can find me at erinmurraywellness.com.
Perfect. And we will link everything. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Erin.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Move Your Brain, Move Your Body podcast. Join in every week as we release new episodes.
subscribe or leave us a rating at Apple Podcasts. If you have questions or topics to cover, please email moveyourbb@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram @moveyourbb.